You know what this is? This is the Copernicus syndrome. Going through the book of Acts. And we're going to pick up where we left off. Here is our theme for the book of Acts. What does the text say? That's about as simple a question as I can ask. All right, I've got the table of contents here. This is a continuation of our foundational teaching about the faith of the early believers. That's what we're going through. We're looking at Acts, so we're going to do a review, obviously. We're going to talk about the birth of the church, Acts 2, verse 1. Stephen is the first Christian martyr. Then we're going to talk about how to read the scriptures to fit a preconceived framework. Today, Paul gets saved on the road to Damascus. And then I've got to ask a question. Was Ananias the best choice? And then finally, at the end of the day, we're looking forward, Peter and his new menu choices. Okay, so this is what we'll be covering today. So let's talk about the birth of the church, Acts 2:1. Anybody familiar with that concept?
Yes.
Any problems?
Yes.
All right, well, we'll reduce the emphasis of it. Okay. During the lifetime of Yeshua, he and his disciples lived the faith that God gave to the Israelites through Moses. We can make a case for that. We know the instructions are the perfect instruction manual, which I defined earlier in the intro, Copernicus syndrome. So far, everything that we saw looking at the first part of Acts, which was chapter 1 through chapter 5, the disciples, then called apostles, they continued the same course. We saw those examples. All right, so let's pick it up at chapter 5, verse 18. Here's what we have. They arrested the apostles and put them in public jail. 19, during the night, an angel of the Lord opened the doors of the jail and brought them out. Verse 20, go stand in the temple courts, tell the people the full message. This is the full message. This is the angel getting them out of prison and telling them to go to the temple courts where everybody is and tell the people the full message. All right, so here's my question. If the Torah's been done away with, wouldn't that be part of the full message? Just a consideration. Continuing, Acts 5:34. We're still within the story, so we're still within the context of them in jail, being released from jail. A Pharisee named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law who was honored by all the people, stood up in the Sanhedrin, ordered that the men be put outside for a little while. All right, so let's look. They have a discussion about what's going on with these guys. They have a discussion about that. Then in verse 38, here is what he deduces is the best plan of action. I advise you leave these men alone. Let them go, for if their purpose or activity is of human origin, it will fail. But if it is from God, you will not be able to stop these men. You'll only find yourselves fighting against God. And the legal counsel, it says that they agreed. All right, so this is pretty simple. They ask them some questions. They get some answers. They leave the room. There's a little bit of discussion. A guy who was well known, well appreciated, understood, respected, makes a suggestion, and they all agree to it. I mean, this is what the text says, right? My comment, by this time, the apostles are known in Jerusalem. I mean, they've been doing some healings, and they've been doing some other stuff. Word has gotten around. Thousands of Jews, proselytes, etc., have agreed that Yeshua is the Messiah. The text has said that. There's no debate about that. All right, so now let's talk about this argument that this, can we call him a rabbi? Is that fair? You know, a teacher, authority figure. Let's talk about the argument that he makes. He says, if this be of God, If this be of God. Okay, so do we believe that he would have said, this, what is going on here, if this is of God, could he be talking about them teaching that the Torah has been done away with? Unlikely. Unlikely. And if you come against these people, you may find yourself fighting against God because God did away with the Torah. I don't think that argument's going to float in the Sanhedrin. All right, let's continue. We're still in chapter 5, moving to verse 42. Day after day in the temple courts. So, after this whole event takes place, what do the apostles do? They go to the temple courts where everybody is, and they continue to proclaim what? The Torah has been done away with, or Yeshua is the one who was spoken of in Tanakh that was going to come. That's what the text says. So far, I know we're only five chapters into 28. I understand that. Has anybody noticed any kind of course correction whatsoever? So far, remember, what does the text say? And I don't want to forget full message. That's big. All right, let's move to chapter 6. The apostles called the disciples together to discuss delegating some of the responsibilities of the daily distribution of food to the widows. Okay, we understand that. So let's look at verse 1. The number of disciples had increased greatly. Well, it was 3,000 back then, so who knows how many it is now. All right. 2. The 12 summons all the disciples. Was that the entire congregation? I don't know. The word all is the word all. But anyway, he got together some folks. Now, let's look at 2. This is verse 2. Ignore the 2 in front of the 6. That's a typo. This is 6:2. This is the Greek word arrestin. It is not arrestin for us to wait on tables and neglect the study of God's word. That's what the text says. It is not arrestin that we do this. So what does the word mean? Pleasing or desirable? Let's take a look at the word for neglect. Means to set to one side in favor of something else. That's what the Greek word that is translated neglect, and you see in the first bullet. So, here's the last bullet. It is not the best course of action for us, the apostles, to wait on tables, setting aside the study of God's word. That's what the text is saying. Now, verse 1 says there was a need. So we're really not debating about the fact that somebody needs to wait on the tables. That's just not what is a focus here. The focus is the Almighty has somebody in mind to take that task. All right, so this begs the question. Are you telling me the apostles are not qualified to help the widows with the food distribution? That's not the question that's on the table. Obviously, the apostles can do that. But the Greek word, combined with the Greek word, tells me that it's not the best idea for us to do this and set aside the study of God's word. That's what the text says. Now, here's how I'm reading this. This implies that what he wants me to do is not going to fully happen until each of you steps up to the plate and does what he wants you to do. There are people that are called to do different things. They have a passion. You can ask them. They'll tell you. So in an assembly community, there are things that need to be done. And each person needs to find out what they're called to do so those things get done. And then those people who are doing things like the apostles feeding the widows can then hand that off to someone who feels a burden for that, and they can go back to what they were called to do. So it's up to the community of people to find out what you're called to do and fill the spot. Am I reading into this text too much? So, here's the question that I put before the community and people who are listening to this off the internet. What's your passion for the kingdom, and how can I or some other person come alongside to make you successful for what you are called to do in the community, which is what this is, a living organism? That's my question. Does this text really say the apostles couldn't continue to do what they were specifically called to do until the rest of the community did what the Almighty wanted them to do? So you need to discover your passion for the kingdom and then step up, execute it. I put lighter up. All right, let's go back. Chapter 6, they called a meeting. Number of disciples increased. 12 summoned all of them. The apostles said, here's the plan. We're going to choose 7 people by vote, and we're going to require 4 things. And you can find these 4 things in 6, verse 3. Here are the 4 things. They need to have a good reputation. They need to be full of the Spirit. They need to be full of wisdom. And they need to understand that we're now under grace and not under the law. Oh, maybe I have a bad translation.
You got a bad translation.
6:5 lists the 7 that were selected. And I'm only just bringing out that one of them was a proselyte. I say this because Luke's writing this letter late to Gentiles, and who really cares about proselytes? Just saying. 7a, the word of God increased the number of disciples in Jerusalem, multiplied exceedingly. Yeah, I went through the Greek text of this, and there were like 3 words of which 2 were like, a whole bunch of people were getting on board. That's what it was saying. Multiplied exceedingly. And the priests. The priests were obedient to something. The priests. All right, we're studying priests, aren't we? Leviticus? Now, they were obedient to the faith. What faith is that? Is that the answer?
No.
Okay. These people were priests. They joined. Guess what? They're still priests. They're still presiding over the sacrificial system. They're still following the faith given to Moses. And they have now come to a belief that Yeshua is the Messiah, the one who was sent, and there are no conflicts noted in the text. What is the question on the table? What does the text say? That's the question. Continuing, Acts 6:9, Stephen goes into one of the synagogues and discusses with the other Jews that the law has been done away with. Oh, probably another bad translation. Stephen goes into one of the synagogues and discusses with the other Jews there about Yeshua's messiahship. Isn't that what it says? So, when were the synagogue meetings? Were they on Sunday? What does history say? I don't think so. Okay, 6:10. Stephen makes his case from the scriptures about the fact that Yeshua was the Messiah and they couldn't defeat him. So, what was plan B? The answer is in verse 11. What does the text say? They secretly hired some men to do something illegal. All right, right there. That should be a red flag. What was it? To say, we've heard Stephen speak words of blasphemy against Moses and against God. And verse 12, they stirred up the people, the elders, the scribes, so they brought him before the council to make a legal determination if these things were so. All right, so we've hired somebody illegal to lie. And we're going to break down that 11b where it says, where's the blasphemy against Moses and God? We're going to talk about that in a second. All right, let me continue here. This blasphemy means coming against something, to blaspheme. This is a big, major word. We've talked about it before. We talked about it in the parables of Luke. We talked about it during the eighth day in Revelation. Watch what the text explains it to be. They're to lie and say that Stephen said the law has been done away with. Now you're saying, wait a minute, I don't see that in the text. Watch. How many people have heard of the Net Bible? Yeah. Protestant Christian resource? I don't know, 10, 20, 30,000 notes for the whole Bible? Okay. I'm going to show you what the text says. We're going to go to footnote number 41 in Acts 6:13. If you have Bible Works 9, it shows up in your Bible Works. Here's the footnote. The law refers to the law of Moses. It elaborates the nature of the blasphemy in verse 11. To speak against God's law, to speak against God's law in Torah was to blaspheme God. So they were hired to lie and say, Stephen is blaspheming God, which means they were hired to say, Stephen said the law was done away with. See what the text says? And here's what's interesting. This is the Net Bible footnotes, and you can see this is right off of it. Right on, go to the web, netbible.com. Pull it up. The link's there. You can get it off the PDF. Deuteronomy 28, 15, 19. This is their exact quote in their text online. This is what it says. All right. Now, from their perspective, what has happened? Yes, I can. Good. Key phrase is the last sentence. Their understanding of blasphemy is to speak against God's law in the Torah. And they quote Deuteronomy 28 to support their case that speaking against the Torah is blaspheming God. Okay, that's how they support it. By quoting Deuteronomy 28. All right, now, what's just happened from their perspective? The first Christian martyr, Stephen, as they see him, was so in the zone when he was in the synagogue talking about this, following the teachings of Moses, that they had to lie and say that he was coming against the law, coming against the Torah. And that's straight out of their notes. Okay? Let's keep going. If Stephen had been teaching that the law had been done away with, would his enemies needed to lie? They could have told the truth. So there was no need to hire them to lie. They could have hired them to tell the truth. I agree. I think they could have told the truth. Oh, yeah. And this is not the last time false witnesses crop up. And I want to thank Dennis because he sent me all the references as he's helping me with my Acts presentation. Thank you, Professor. He finds out what section of Acts I'm teaching on, and then he collects all his notes and sends them to me. So, there you go. All right, moving to Acts 7:1. So, here is, I don't know if trial is the right word, but let's go with trial. The high priest says, is this true, what these guys are saying about you? Is this true? In our parlance, we would say, how do you plead? Guilty or not guilty? Tell me. So, what are we talking about? Did you actually go into the synagogue and tell people the law had been done away with? Because that's what blaspheming God means. And he's going to answer with the historical method. So, we're going to go through the history of Israel, except we're going to go through it rather fast. Okay? You think he goes through it fast. All right. Now, let's take a slight tangent. How to read the scriptures to fit a preconceived framework. No, this is going to be fun. This is going to be fun. Stay with me. All right. Here's the question on the table. What is replacement theology? You got something here, and then you take this and remove this and replace it with this. Okay, so make sure we're all on the same page here. We got this, and then we're going to remove it and replace it with this. That's replacement theology, without getting too technical. All right, let's go to Acts 7. I said we'd go through his story fast. This is Moses, which said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall Yahweh your Elohim raise up unto you of your brethren, like unto me, him shall ye hear. All right, so right there, he's quoting as part of his defense what he was saying in the synagogue, which was arguing that Yeshua was the Messiah. So we saw it in the other text, and here he is repeating it in his defense. In 38a, this is the one who was in the ecclesia, in the wilderness. All right, now, this is where we're going to look at how subtle the attacks are that we face. Ecclesia in the New Testament occurs 114 times, and yes, I looked at all of them. 109 times out of 114 times is translated as church. That means there's five that's not. Three times is translated as an assembly, and that's in Acts 19, and we'll just get those three out of the way. There was a gathering of Ephesian idol makers in a theater, and they dragged in two Jews with them. These were the traveling companions of Paul, and they were having a meeting of some type. And the NASB translates ecclesia as assembly in those three verses. Now, out of the 114, 109 it's translated as church, but these three it's translated as assembly, and I think that's a pretty good translation. Okay, it was a gathering of people. It wasn't really a church service. But that leaves two, right?
Yes.
114 minus 109 equals 5 minus 3 equals 2. Okay, here we go. Two times the NASB, New American Standard Bible, translates this as congregation. Okay, well let's talk about that. What's the first occurrence? Hebrews 2:12. I will proclaim, this is a quote of the Old Testament. In Hebrews 2:12, remember, this is making the case for who Yeshua is in the pecking order. I will proclaim thy name to my brethren in the midst of the congregation. I will sing thy praise. The Greek word that is ekklesia. Hebrews 2:12. And this is a quote of Psalm 22:22. Now, there is a footnote. So let's read this quote in Psalm 22:22. I will tell of thy name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly, not congregation. So in Psalm 22:22, the New American Standard translates it as assembly, but in Hebrews 2:12, they translate it as congregation. Let's see why. Why would they do that? Ecclesia, 114 times. 109 is church. Footnote 52. Look at what they say this is. It refers to the psalmist's fellow members of the Israelite covenant community. They could not have said it any better. So it would appear to me that they understand kahal in the Hebrew text here in 22:22. Okay? I submit that they don't think the Israelite covenant community is the same entity as the Christian church. Okay? Watch this unfold. Let's go back. What do we got? The one who was in the ecclesia, 114 times, New Testament, 109, it's the church. Three times, it's assembly. Two times, it's congregation. One of them is Hebrews 2:12. What is the other one? Acts 7:38. This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness. All right, let's look at footnote 104. The term ekklesia is a secular use of the term that came to mean church in the epistles. Here, a reference to an assembly is all that is intended. Really? This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness. Oh, this is just a secular assembly. That's all that was intended by the use of this word here, is what they say. All right, now I'm just going to, for the fun of it, Daily Bible Study, that's a website, congregation, there's the path. Here's the quote. Congregation is most often used to translate the original Hebrew words of the Old Testament, which were used primarily to describe the Israelites in a sense of a gathering of the Lord's holy people. But that's not how they see it. It's just a secular assembly. That's all it means. Now, NASB, really? This is how you understand it? You understood Psalm 22:22 correctly? You translated it from the Hebrew Kahal correctly? Could this really be your stand? Are you consistently purporting this? Uh-oh. 1 Corinthians 10:1. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink, drinking from the spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was who? Moses? That's not what the NASB put. They said the rock was Christ. But here it says, this is the one in the congregation in the wilderness, the secular assembly. Now I'm confused. Over here you're saying this, and over here you're saying this. What am I supposed to do? This is the footnote. All right? Get this in your head, because I'm going to continue building on this. Pass through the sea. Baptized into Moses. Same spiritual food. Same spiritual drink. The rock which was Christ. But this is only a reference to an assembly of persons. There you go. All right. We're not through with verse 38. The angel who was speaking to him at Mount Sinai and who was with our fathers, he received living oracles to pass on to you. Now, think about this. Think about this. What if the NASB had translated that as church, just the way the KJV does? If you go to Hebrews 2:12 and you go to Acts 7:38 and you look at the text in the KJV, both of those are translated as church. So it's the church in the wilderness. But not the NASB, which was translated 4 centuries later. Actually, 3 and a half. Okay? So if they had said that this was the church in the wilderness, they would be linking what took place in the wilderness and what's taking place now. They'd be linking them together, and that would be opposed to replacing them. So to support replacement theology, they are not consistent. It's subtle. I'm just letting you know. All right, now, here, this is footnote number 108 in Acts 7:38b. It says, oracles is translated as messages. This is an allusion to the law. Okay, let's see what we got with that. This is a wiki. Allusion is a figure of speech in which one refers covertly or indirectly to an object. So, receive living oracles. This is the story that's going on. Let's look at the Greek behind it. Zoe. Not Zoe. The Greek word Zoe. Present tense, living. And the word oracles. So, what is he saying? They are alive. In his defense of the Torah. It is a living, speaking logos. And why did Moses receive them? To pass on to you, jury, who has now called me to testify on what I was doing in the synagogue. They were to be passed on to you, and they are living today. Indictment. In his mind, they apply as much today as they do when Moses received them. One more point on 738. Footnote 109. Stephen, perhaps, does not wish to disassociate himself from those who received God's revelation in the past. Think about that. Think about it. Stephen does not wish to disassociate himself from those who received God's revelation. Prophets, Moses, rest of the gang. Okay? But he does want to disassociate himself from those who misinterpreted and disobeyed that revelation. This is a quote in the footnote from the textual commentary of the Greek New Testament. That's what TCGNT is, textual commentary of the Greek New Testament. They quoted that to explain what's going on in this verse. Disassociate himself from those who misinterpreted and disobeyed the Torah. So, yes, I'm with you. This was given by Moses. I'm with you. But I am not part of those people who misinterpreted and disobeyed what Moses said. How does he follow that up? You are stiff-necked, uncircumcised, always resisting the Spirit of God. You're doing exactly as your fathers did. Which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? They killed. Look at this. What is he talking about in the synagogues? They killed those who had previously announced the coming of the righteous one. He's in the synagogue talking, announcing about the coming one who's now dead and risen, but you know what I'm saying, past tense and present tense. They killed those who announced the coming of the anointed one. And now you're holding me on trial because I'm talking about the coming one. You're just like them, disobeying God because these oracles are living and you will be held accountable right now. What a great defense. They're going to love him. He says, you received the law and yet you did not obey it. All right, so we know how that trial turned out. Here's a summary of what he's saying. One, the Torah leads directly to Yeshua being the promised one. Just as the fathers have demonstrated, Israel has now once again disobeyed the Torah, this time by not accepting Yeshua as the one. Number three, all the words given to Moses are still active and alive today, Zoe Logos. And four, dudes, all y'all are guilty. That's what he said. And they didn't like it. How shocking is that? All right, so this speech is like a prophecy. Because when they begin to stone him, what did he say in 52? You're killing the people who are making the announcement. So that's what you're doing to me. So it's almost like a prophecy. 58. They laid down their robes at a young man's feet. His name was Saul. And he agreed completely with murdering Stephen. I looked the Greek up. Murdering is the correct translation of the Greek word there. All right, let's go to verse 3. Saul began to destroy the church. This is NIV. Going from house to house, he dragged off both men and women and put them in prison. Now, we looked at blaspheme, right? We talked about it just a little bit. Later, we're going to discover that he tried to make them blaspheme, which means what? Deny the Torah. He was going to try to make them deny the Torah. So obviously they weren't denying the Torah. So what does this text say? 9:1. Meanwhile, Saul, still breathing out threats to murder the Lord's disciples, went to the high priest and requested letters from him to the synagogues in Damascus. Now, what's interesting about this is that we're down the road a few years, toward the end of the 30s, and it's still a Sadducean high priest. And he didn't go and demand letters. The Greek word is not demand. The Greek word was request of the high priest. So he had to ask and it be permitted that these letters be given him. Makes me question just how much pharisaical authority was existing at the time in the Sadducean priesthood execution at the end of the third decade. It's a question in my mind. Okay? So that if any... Oh, requested letters from him to the synagogues? So that if they found any who belonged to the way, he could bring them as prisoners. Okay. Let's define who Paul is after. They're called the way, but they're not called Christians. They meet in synagogues on the Sabbath and not on Sunday. They're followers of the faith given to Moses. And in contrast to other Jews, think about this, because we're going to get into this later when we talk about the end of the first century, when we talk about who is a Jew, and we're going to deal with it from the rabbinic side. Contrast to other Jews, believe Yeshua is the promised Messiah to Israel. So the only difference here between Paul and the people he was hunting down was that they thought Yeshua was the Messiah, and he didn't. That's the difference. Has nothing. The text doesn't say anything about the law. Not yet. All right. What do we know? We're 7 to 10 years out. Everyone that's been referred to so far continues to live according to the perfect instruction manual. That's Psalm 19:7. The Torah of Yahweh is perfect, converting the soul. Literal fulfillment of future prophecies is still alive in the minds of the believers versus what I was taught, which was all future prophecies now must be interpreted spiritually because nothing else is going to be fulfilled physically. But I'm not, the text doesn't seem to be saying that yet to me. And so far, I don't see a hint of a change on the horizon. So far, question on the table, what does the text say? Time for the arrival of Yeshua has been set by the Father. We saw that in Acts chapter 1. Just as he did with Moses and those who were saved out of the oppression of Egypt, he speaks and acts within the context of the human culture today, the first century, and the time of Egypt. He's always doing his stuff within the culture of the day, and he makes it work. Contained within the instruction manual was a prophecy about one who was to come. I mean, I'm not talking about a single isolated allusion that's questionable. I'm talking about a lot of passages that talk about one who's coming. And then the prophets add additional detail. He was born into a specific prophesied family and line that ordered their lives after the faith given to Moses. I mean, this is what the text is saying. He ordered his life according to this PIM. Who were the people? They were the people God himself chose to bear his name. These were the people Yeshua came into. They knew their history, and they fiercely debated about how God wanted them to live out the PIM. You can read that in first century history and a little bit in the pre-first century history. They had discussions. I mean, I was thinking about this week, so I'll just bring this one up. There, the Pharisees were still speaking the name prior to the first century, and they were called the name speakers. And then there were other Pharisees that didn't speak the name, and they called each other names. I read that document, and it was so funny. Reminded me of school children. Okay. He addressed interpretations that had issues. We see that in the Gospels. That's not new news. He knew that he would live as a teacher and disciple 12, not 11. We know how Judas turned out, but that's irrelevant. He discipled Judas, period. There is no more discussion after that. Judas was one of the 12. He discipled Judas just like he discipled the other 11. Deal with that. He declared there'd be no divisions in the PIM and that all the instructions would be in effect until heaven and earth ceased and all prophecy had been fulfilled. That's Matthew 5, 17 and 18. Don't think some. You can see the teaching we've already done on that. After his resurrection, but before his ascension, he instructed the disciples to go out. You know what? You know what the English text says? Go out and make disciples. What's the verb? Make. What's the noun? Disciples. Let me open your head, pour in the correct truth, close your head, now you're a disciple. That's not what the text says. It's a verb. You are to go out and disciple others by bringing your life into such a line that these people are going to want to model their life after you. Slightly different. And that's exactly what the disciples did. So, repeating again, we're 7 to 10 out. And everybody's still with the perfect instruction manual so far. What was our plan? Examine how the disciples live. I need to know how the disciples live because I'd like to think Yeshua was a great teacher. A great teacher. Doesn't matter how bad the students are. I like to think Yeshua is a great teacher. So, did the disciples get anything? If he was teaching then, as soon as I'm dead, the law is done away with, the disciples really missed it. But the text doesn't say that. You have to come to the text with a preconceived framework to see that. Let's let what the disciples did teach and train us. That's what the text says. Okay, they're continuing to be followers. They study. They're at the temple. Sabbath, priests, sacrifices that were required. They're performing all of this. Sacrifices wasn't done away with. The priest came in at 6-7. We just saw it. They're still doing the sacrificial system. Be careful what you read. Here's the question. If we're looking for those that are in covenant with the Creator, why wouldn't we look for those who order their lives after the perfect instruction manual? Doesn't look like it's been done away with. We're 7 to 10 out. Just a question, and it remains on the table. Now, back to 9:2. Letter was requested by Paul, the synagogue, the way. The only difference, as I said before, they believe Yeshua was the promised one. Paul does not. Now, Paul adds some details to the events in chapter 9, we need to look at those details so that we get a full picture of what's happening in chapter 9. So we're going to go to Acts 22, verse 1. Paul is now finding himself in a defensive position. He says, "Men and brethren and fathers, hear my defense. I was brought up at the feet of the man." This is the man from chapter 5. Taught according to the... Look at what he's saying. Taught according to the perfect man of the law of the fathers, zealous toward God, as all of you are today. So right here, he is saying that you guys are still following the Torah. These Jews are still following the Torah. And he's saying, I was brought up the same way. Doesn't the text say that? What do you think it means? 4, I persecuted the way unto death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women. What was the one difference? They thought Yeshua was the Messiah. High priests and elders testify. They could. I received letters so I could bring these people to Jerusalem. 6 through 11, during my trip to Damascus, I encountered Yeshua and being left blind, I was brought into the city. Okay, so we're still in chapter 9, even though we're in chapter 22. A certain Ananias, one, devout by the standard of the law. Oh, well, you know, that's a little fishy. What might that mean? Well, let's go to 2. Highly respected by all the Jews living there. Okay, now, we know the Jews are still following the Torah. They're respecting this guy who is devout. So, is Ananias keeping Torah? What does the text say? And he says, Paul, receive your sight. Then he says, the God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will and see the just one and should hear him speak. The will of God. You will be a witness. We know what witness means. All right, let's review. God of our fathers chosen you that you would know his will. What do we know about God's will? Let me tell you what we know about God's will. Surely the sovereign Yahweh does nothing without revealing his plans to his servants, the prophets. That's what we know about God's will. So what does that mean for us? Whatever we think Paul will teach, whatever we think he's teaching, we can be sure we can find it in the prophets. Is that not what Ananias said? Example, if we interpret that Paul is teaching X, I'm a math major, sorry, teaching X, then if we can find it in the prophets, then we're understanding what Paul's talking about. But if we can't find it, then our interpretation of Paul is in error. Because the will of God is Amos 3:7. I call that very awesome. Now, 16, Ananias, what are you waiting for, dude? Get up, be baptized, wash your sins away, calling on his name. All right, now, what have we got? This is new Paul. This is new Paul. When I returned to Jerusalem, I was praying at the temple. Fell into a trance. Paul, it's time to leave. That was Yeshua speaking to him. Lord, they know that I imprisoned and beat in every synagogue them that believed that you were the Messiah. And when the blood of Stephen was shed, I vote guilty and stood by as it took place. We're still in chapter 9. Let's go to 26. Paul's got another defense. We're interested in his past. I too was convinced that I ought to do all that was possible to oppose the name of Yeshua. 10. And that is just what I did. On the authority of the chief priests, I put many of the saints in prison. When they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. 11. Many a time I went from one synagogue to another to have them punished, and I tried to force them to blaspheme. I tried to force them to say that they were against the Torah of God. In my obsession against them, I even went to foreign cities to persecute them. Once again, what do we see in this text? The believers in Yeshua were still in the synagogues. That slipped by me. As if that was normal and expected behavior. And we've already seen what blaspheme means. Continuing in 26, what is the call? Paul says his call was the following, to open their eyes, it's a figure of speech, turn them from darkness, what does that mean, to light. What does that mean? Well, we know it's a parallel. Darkness from the power of Satan unto God's Torah, which is the light. How many people know Psalm 119, verse 105? Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. I'm supposed to turn them to light? Ooh, that's the call. Continuing, so that they may receive forgiveness of sins Well, what is sin? Oh, yeah, we want to go there today. Paul addresses sins in Romans. We'll get there when we get there. Let's continue in verse 18. An inheritance among them which are sanctified by faith in me. This is an action verb. During the homework today, David Johnson is going to explain this in ultimate detail. Sanctified by faith. Answering the question, what is sanctification? Okay, now let's go back to 9. Remember, the only difference? They believed Yeshua was the one. He didn't. Then it happens. This is what we've been waiting for. Paul meets Yeshua. They have a short discussion. Paul becomes saved from being a Pharisee to being a Christian. I'm going to have to change this Bible. It's not working out. This is what's taught, but it's not what the text says. In reality, it couldn't be further from the truth. What happened? A single thing happened. He became just like the rest of the ones he was persecuting. He believed Yeshua was the Messiah. He continued to follow the faith. He makes it clear many times. We'll get to it when we get there. Continuing, Acts 9, verse 10. Of all the disciples that had been chosen by God to minister to Paul, Ananias was the one that was called. A devout observer of the faith. Highly respected by all the Jews, means he was all the way in. Man, what does the text say? 7 to 10 years, the believers in Yeshua have not even begun to disavow the faith given to Moses. That's what the text says. If we're to take Yeshua as a great teacher, how the disciples live their lives has got to be taken into the equation of how we're to live our lives. Or what are we doing? Verse 20, straightway he preached Christ in the synagogues that he's the Son of God. He joined others of the way. He eventually ended up with the apostles in Jerusalem. Then he was sent home to Taurus. All right, that's the end of 9. So, what do we know? You know, I'm looking at the text. I'm trying to see what the text says. And it looks like to me, at the end of chapter 9, we're 7 to 10 years out, and things are looking awfully the same. I'm just not seeing this other stuff. Not seeing it. You got to do some reading into the text to make it say something else. So, this is where Copernicus syndrome comes in. Don't be caught short by not considering the evidence that's presented. All right. The end.